Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You know what I love about this? You could never tell they were rich. It's all so classy and understated.
I'll make it up to you later.
Make it up to me now. Let's find a room. They must have a few.
You're so bad.
This is what rich, entitled people do when threatened. They conceal the ugly truths to protect themselves.
The community is in shock tonight over the gruesome discovery of a fourth grade mother found bludgeoned to death.
Hello and welcome to the final episode of Still Watching The Undoing. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you're just joining us, what we do on this podcast every week is that Richard and I pick a show that we're currently watching kind of obsessively. We break down the latest episode. We give our impressions. Sometimes we have interviews. We've got two great interviews for this last episode of The Undoing. We've got Nicole Kidman and we've got Susanna Beer, who directed every episode. So what more could you ask for? Hugh Grant is on the run as far as I know. So Nicole is left here to tell her story.
And she called in from a helicopter, is that right?
Incredible stuff. You can't tell it because our editor is a genius, so you won't hear the helicopter blades, but live from a helicopter, it's Nicole Kidman. So we're here to talk about the finale of The Undoing, and I just want to issue a quick correction on something I said the last couple episodes about our plans for the flight attendant. For some reason, I thought it was a 6-episode show. It is an 8-episode show. It does not change our release schedule. We will still be releasing the last episode when I said we would be, but you will, instead of like dropping one episode at a time, they're dropping 2 episodes at a time. So you, the viewer, will have 2 extra hours to spend with Kaley Cuoco hopping around the globe in The Flight Attendant. And Richard and I will have 2 more hours of television to talk about, but like we're still only doing 2 episodes for the whole season, if that makes sense. So my apologies for the confusion there. I've heard back from some of our listeners who are already watching The Flight Attendant and they are loving it absolutely. So I really, really recommend you guys board that plane because it is a really, really good time and kind of like a fun companion to The Undoing, because it's like equally in the world of like upper echelon of society and murder, but like but a different tone entirely. And so it's sort of like a nice little light thing to hop to. Yes, there's murder, but it's definitely lighter than The Undoing. So there's that. Richard, anything you want to say about The Flight Attendant or anything else before we get into this?
I guess only that like people should watch The Flight Attendant, not just to listen to this, but because I don't know, over the Thanksgiving holiday, that show really seems to have blown up. I saw a lot of people being like, I never thought of Kaley Cuoco this way, which is kind of what we talked about in our first episode about the show, is about like this kind of reinvention of her. So that's interesting. There's going to be a mystery to follow along with, as there was with The Undoing. So if you're feeling bereft of that now that The Undoing is over, just turn to the other part of HBO, the less clearly defined part, and watch The Flight Attendant. And yeah, we'll circle back with another reaction episode for that.
So let us, we got a bunch of emails about the Anuing. Most of them were theories before the finale. Most of them were really elaborate theories. None of those elaborate theories wound up panning out in the episode. So I don't know that I'm going to like go down all of those rabbit holes, but I will say like a lot of people suspected that Lily Rabe was going to like, was either the murder, like they were like, she's got something to do. And she did have something, bit of a something to do in this episode. And I also think what's true, you know, is that you and I were like, you don't cast Noah Jupe unless you're going to ask him to do a lot. And I think he does a lot in this finale. And so I don't think that that was really off the mark, us saying that. But in the end, it was the first suspect is the last suspect. He did it in the book. He did it in the show. It is Hugh Grant. He is the murderer. So the big question, I think, about The Undoing as people are processing it is something that Susanna Beer said to me sort of when this all kicked off, is that, you know, David E. Kelley delivered a script to her that was a sort of a more faithful adaptation of the book, which is not a whodunit. The book is not a whodunit. You know who done it. It's Jonathan Frazier. And so the book is more about how Grace comes undone with that knowledge. And that's what David E. Kelley gave to Susanna Beer. And Susanna Beer is like, what if instead we make it a whodunit? So the question we're facing now that the whole season is done is, do we think that was the right move, or was there a way to do that, to make it a mystery and still circle back and land with the first suspect is the last suspect? Do you have any thoughts on that, Richard?
Well, I was thinking about it last night when we watched, when I watched the show, and you know, the title of the book is You Should Have Known. Mm-hmm. It's like, we should have known. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's a little bit of a bait and switch to craft this as a, you know, a proper whodunit, wherein the thinking is, well, there's going to be twists and turns, and so it's not the first person we suspect or the second person we suspect, you know. And then to be like, oh, no, it was this thing all the whole time, you know. I think that's a little bit frustrating from, like, a television viewing perspective. But I think that more sort of literarily, more textually, like, there is something interesting about that, like, I had begun to, like, assume that Jonathan hadn't done it, and mostly because I just trusted that, like, this kind of narrative is going to take us somewhere unexpected.
Right.
But also because, like, maybe it seemed like, oh, it's too obvious that it's the rich white guy doctor. Like, you know, there has to be something more complicated to it. And I think that they're like, no, he was a violent liar and he did it, you know, and like Occam's razor would suggest. So I think that there was some sort of commentary in there, maybe a little bit, about where we place suspicions and how we justify giving people like Jonathan Frazier in the real world the very prolonged benefit of the doubt.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, like the question of the, like, there were a couple things that were really interesting to me in the finale. And so one question of, like, could he get away with it? How much does privilege insulate a person like Jonathan Frazier in a way that it wouldn't insulate another character? Like, he almost gets away with it because he has, like, a certain kind of lawyer and a certain kind of, like, respect, air of respectability around him and stuff like that. The other thing that I was thinking about is, I think it's, this is David E. Kelley. We've been talking for a couple episodes about the fact that, like, David E. Kelley does courtroom drama and courtroom twists very well. You know, I don't know that this is, like, the very, very best example of his work, but I do think the idea of, like, Grace going on the stand as a witness for the defense and using that to damn him, like, through back channels and stuff like that, like a clever, like, you know, navigation of legal loopholes to stitch him up real tight. Like, that's fun to watch in its own way. I guess I wish I don't know that I needed suspense around whodunit, but maybe I needed more suspense about whether or not Grace would have hung him out to dry in this way, which I think, you know, they were trying to show us her wrestling with it. But I had no doubt heading into this, like, not just because we see her, like, confer with Lily Rabe and we see Lily Rabe talk to the prosecutor in the bathroom and stuff like that. Like, I just think I had no doubt, given who Grace is, that she was asking to be put on the stand so that she could hang him out to dry. And I kind of wish that that had been something I didn't see coming. Do you know anything?
Oh, I was surprised.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. Never mind.
But I think that I was maybe in the minority in that, because I was watching it with my boyfriend, and he was like, he was clued into that. He'd watched the whole five episodes that day, like on Sunday, and then like we watched the finale together, and he was like, he knew it right away. And I was like, oh wait, look, there, she's like actually, you know, sending him up the river. And he was like, yeah, duh. So I think it really is just in the eye of the beholder. But like, I think I also really, I was like a lot of our emailers, and like me when I watched Lost or Westworld or whatever, I was so caught up in my like intricate theories that more obvious developments were sort of, I was blind to them, you know?
Okay. I see that.
Like,
yeah.
even as like at the bitter end is like Jonathan in the car with Henry, I was like, it's still going to reveal that it was someone else.
It's just not. It was just him. Yeah, exactly. Well, let's go to our interview with Susanna Bier. This was recorded, before the season even debuted. So like to context of where we are. And I had not seen the finale when I talked to her. So I will not be asking finale specific questions, but I still think some of what she has to say about her thinking behind creating this season is interesting. So let us hear from Susanna Bier. I've learned so much about your process this week. It's been really, really fun and fascinating to me. But one thing I heard that you do that I just think is really interesting is this idea of giving the performer room and time to sort of warm up in the space before you actually start the scene. Is this something you've always done? And what do you feel like is accomplished in doing that?
Yeah, it's something I've done it as long as I remember, and I can't remember when I started doing it. I guess I started feeling that, you know, that the cast and myself needed the space to play and needed a bit of a playground before the crew, before everybody came and everything became real and everything became slightly technical. And so what it does is that it's sort of, we have ownership of the set and we can play with it and we can define ourselves and we can have all the conversations and all the argument and all the fun. And then once the crew comes onto set, there is something, there is like a real robust sense of where the scenes needs to go. It's an investigation, but what it also does, other than investigate and finding some version of truth, it also gives a weird calmness to everyone. Because we've been there, we talked about it, we know it, and we have this odd secret. Even if we share it with the, you know, even if we share the physical, he will go there, she will be standing there. Even if we share that once the crew comes on board, the sort of emotional layers have been tried and are now protected by having been worked on before everybody comes there.
I don't know why everyone doesn't do it that way.
I don't know either. Each director's process is different. And mm-hmm. I think it might not be useful for a lot of directors. So, but for me, it's a necessity.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about outside of, you know, the script and then your interpretation of the script, when you're constructing a thriller, whether or not you're trying to do Hitchcock or anything like that, how do you ensure, or do you even think about it this way, that the audience's suspicion is constantly shifting? What outside, you know, the twists and turns that are on the page create that or drive that guessing game that's part of the fun of watching a thriller?
It's very much a question of who looks at who. who has, who, I mean, it's to an extent, for it to be successful, it's everything, it's just as important, everything which is not on the page. Mm. All the details, all the, you know, is somebody like fumbling with her back? Is somebody, you know, it's all the small signs. It's all the, and also again, I mean, you know, does the light come in of the window? Are we seeing something slightly irrational, which makes us feel uneasy about something which should be completely comfortable? Mm. So it's about all those small, meticulously planted details which are not rational and which are not necessarily part of the narrative, but which is part of the atmosphere and which is somewhat more subconscious. And, you know, it's very hard to say exactly what it is, but it's incredibly tangible. Like if you took out all those elements, you wouldn't be sitting on the edge of the seat. Because I mean, you do see thrillers which have all those turns, and it doesn't really impact you. Mm-hmm. because it's very much about details. It's very much about the way Nicole looks, or does Hugh like drop something and then pick it up? Or, you know, it's about all sorts of irrational thing. And those irrational things, they come on set, but they also sometimes come at the rehearsal. But those irrational things have very much to do with not being too limiting. You know, they are kind of, it's the life that happens while you do it.
So does that mean just being open to whatever may come in the rehearsal process, that feels like it adds to that environment?
No, it's not just about being open. Mm-hmm. And also it's throughout the day. It's also throughout the entire day. It's also when you shoot. But mm-hmm. it's more about nurturing mm-hmm. and cultivating those unexpected beats. And creating them, you know, it's also about enforcing a situation where they can thrive.
Can I circle back to a question, something you said that I'm just curious to know more about? You mentioned the light coming through the window. Are you able to talk specifically about the lighting on this show and how that contributes to that unease that we feel watching it?
Yes, I don't know whether it's the lighting as such as, but as the sort of, you know, the combination of darkness and light, and I want to say, you know, that it's the whole visual. It's the, you know, it's also the lenses. It's also the fact that there are. That the camera is slightly worried. You know, the camera is consciously slightly nervous. And I don't mean sort of handheld, insane nervous, but there is a constant sense of movement.
Yeah.
And that is a huge factor in that sense of unease that you have. Because it kind of never really allows you to relax.
Can you talk a little bit about the flashbacks that appear? They're very sparing. You know, it's not nearly so impressionistic as, you know, what they were doing on season one of Big Little Lies, for example, or something like that. But there are these carefully planted flashes, often sort of in a like a honey gold color type of thing. Can you talk about your decisions around those and how to use them?
Well, you know, we are slightly teasing you with the flashbacks because we are not entirely clear about them being flashbacks or being someone's imagination. Mm-hmm. And or both. possibly. And you know, it was funny because at some point we did an edit where we took them all out. And it weirdly worked, but it was just somewhat less exciting because we weren't steering up questions which those flashbacks are steering up. And so we changed them and put them back in a different way. But it's you know, it's always a precocious balance with flashbacks because you kind of, you know, they are very seductive, but also they might actually damage what comes after if they sit in the wrong way. So we were kind of, yeah, there was a lot of experimentation with those.
And then I wanted to ask you another casting question, and this is about Noah. I'm a huge Noah fan. I've seen him, you know, he's so young and has already done so much incredible work. You know, but casting for a kid can be really hard, especially a kid is centrally positioned as this kid. You know, what are you looking for in a child performer, and what did Noah specifically bring to the table in that regard?
You know, he was a night manager, and at that time he was probably 8 or something.
That's right.
And he was amazing. And he did the scene where he was kidnapped, which is a very, very scary scene and a very scary scene for a young kid. And so I knew him and I knew how insanely talented he is. And so it was fun now work with him quite a while later, where he's now like kind of a young man and sort of has opinions and has a kind of obviously a bigger awareness of what is he do, but is equally talented. I think in general, what I'm looking for in children acting is sort of the same as grown up, is that kind of instinctive sense of another character. And even very small kids, if they're talented, have that. They kind of understand what somebody would be doing, how somebody would be responding, whether somebody would be sitting or standing. They sort of get it, even if it's not articulate. And with Noah, it's now way more articulate, but he's kind of very sensitive and very emotional, but he's also someone with a great sense of humor. But, you know, he carries himself. I mean, he kind of holds his own, particularly with he could be intimidating with the cast he's surrounded by, but he's not sort of thrown.
Yeah. Donald Sutherland alone, you're like, oh my goodness. And then my last question for you, and thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. This might be a tricky question to answer. I think it'll be okay. But my question is, when you were first reading the script, you get the script, you're first reading it. This is a whodunit.
Actually, it wasn't.
Oh, it wasn't?
Because the first version of the first draft was not so much whodunit, but more into the characters.
Oh, okay.
And so I guess I was kind of asking David, do you think it could be more whodunit and more thriller? And he was like, yes, absolutely. But it kind of happened more during the process than it did initially.
Oh, that's fascinating. So you knew whodunit from the very beginning when you were reading the project.
Yes.
Okay. So much for my question, which was like, when did you figure it out, and were you surprised and shocked? But that's so interesting that it was then retroactively sort of repositioned to be such a mystery.
You know, I think David Kelly is kind of, he's quite playful, and I think that game was very intriguing for him to kind of really enforce that. You know, it might have been in the back of his mind, but the first episode could have definitely gone more kind of family drama and less thriller, But I was quite keen to kind of, I was asking him to make it more thriller risk.
Speaking of playful, Hugh Grant asked me who I thought did it, and I bet you he asked every single person he talked to.
I'm sure he does. And what did you say?
So I've only seen up through episode 5, and so I'll be as honest with you as I was with him, which is that I was suspicious of Noah from the beginning only because I know what Noah could do. And so I was like, I don't think you cast Noah unless you're going to ask him to do something really big. So I was like, well, what if it's Noah? But then I got my beady little eyes on Donald Sutherland at one point as well. So, you know, it's working on me. I'm bouncing around. I don't know what to say. So that's where I am. I did ask Lily why her character keeps making meaningful eye contact with the prosecutor. And she told me to stay tuned. So that is one clue that I am trying to follow. We'll see what happens. But I think that hopefully that speaks to what you were trying to establish in terms of, like, it's not necessarily on the page, it's the glances exchanged and, you know, that sort of stuff. So if that's exactly the case, it's working on me.
Good.
Well, thank you again so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care. Yeah.
You too. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Richard, is there a performance in this episode that particularly sticks out to you as, like, one that you were most compelled by?
Well, I mean, Kidman in the, you know, witness box or whatever, like, that was pretty compelling. And she's so good at that kind of deftly modulated, like, she's playing this professional, intelligent woman who by her career training has to be measured and, you know, but precise, you know. And and I thought that was just, like, really mesmerizing to watch, because she'd never betrayed what Grace was actually doing in the acting. It was all, you know, it was all pretty deftly done. I also think that, you know, we have talked about him a little bit, but he hasn't really gotten much to do, like, vocally. But I thought that Eden Alexander playing Miguel, you know, it's a quiet, sad scene when he's being, yeah, you know, questioned on by these lawyers, or by one lawyer. But I thought that he did a really good job with a tricky kind of moment. And it really, you know, I had hoped, I'd said in an earlier episode that I hoped the show kind of ended on a consideration of him, because he is so like at the dead center of this and has been so little spoken about, you know. And the show obviously was not going in that direction. Ultimately, it didn't have that sort of commentary, you know, front of mind, atop of mind. But, like, I still think that testimony moment at least reminded us of this kid whose life has been really gutted by this whole, you know, sordid thing.
I thought that was a beautiful scene. I thought it was, like, you know, it's upsetting to watch, but I think that his performance, like, he was so good. And then all the adults in the room were doing a great job of watching him, because it's such an awful thing. You know, however gentle the questions, it was just such an awful thing. You know, as part of Haley's, you know, do whatever it takes to win tactics. And the thing that I like about Haley's character is, like, She doesn't strike me as a monster. Like, she wants to win. That's her job, is to win. She doesn't strike me as a monster. But I just find it, I think what's the most interesting in this episode is, like, where is your moral line? Which is something that Grace is dealing with. Where is my moral line? What feels like the moral thing to do? What feels like the right thing to do? And similarly with Haley, you know what I mean? Like, she's when she turns on him and is like, you didn't get rid of the hammer, you're a fucking idiot. You know what I mean? Like, you see where her moral line is, which is maybe a little further down the road than mm-hmm. you had hoped it would be. I don't want to like unfairly compare The Undoing to other shows, but I did find myself thinking a lot about Succession because we keep referencing this one line from Succession, which is no real person evolved, in this idea of like maybe how Jonathan thinks about Elena, or Elena as he calls her. Like, does he love her, or is she not a real person? Is anyone who's not Jonathan himself a real person to him? You know, like, that's sort of the question. But like, I was thinking, I was like, okay, but what Succession does really, really well is there's a crime. There's no question about who did the crime, but there's a question about where how low people allow themselves to sink in order to preserve their own comfort, or feed their own ambition in Succession. And that's really interesting to me. And I think it would have been more interesting to me to watch Grace know the whole time that her husband did this and feel a lot more ambiguity about, I mean, like, feel her astonishment, but also feel, at least from my point of view, a lot more ambiguity about, well, but is she gonna upset the apple cart of her life for this, you know, for this moral right here? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I was just trying to like, because the performances in this show are so good, because the direction is so good, I was just watching the finale, not connecting with it exactly the way I wanted to, and I was just busily trying to figure out how would I have constructed this season so that all of those things could have worked in concert together, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky because, you know, if you already know, then it becomes much more of a drama, which is less marketable in this true crime boom era, you know?
Right, right.
But it would have been maybe more thematically honest in a way. Like, I don't know. It's difficult. And I think that, like, you know, obviously online there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the finale. I would count myself among them to some extent, but I think I liked it more than other people did. But I think in that dissatisfaction, because there had been such a buildup, some crucial things get lost, like the scenes we're talking about, these great performances we're talking about. I think that Noma Demiz, when as Haley, when you see her finally let the mask slip,
yeah,
and she's like, because you didn't hide the fucking hammer or something, yeah, or, you know, you're like, oh, she's like pretty much not on the side of bad exactly, but like, she's an operator, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I also think to that extent, like, Hugh Grant is excellent in those final scenes. Like, some of the more interesting, like, daring, like, you know, outside of his comfort zone acting, I think we've seen him do maybe ever. And yes, that acting was ultimately in service of a finale that people didn't like, or some people didn't like. But like, on its merits alone, like, his, like, he's so good in that scene. And I think that the way that character ultimately is drawn as this terrifying, pathetic, you know, just duplicitous person trying to live two lives at once, like, I think it's a really compelling portrait of that kind of person, and maybe particularly of that kind of wealthy white man.
Were you speaking to the car chase specifically, or?
Yeah, I think the car chase when he is with Henry and he's trying in that very, you know, sort of sing-song Hugh Grant-y way, just try to be like, oh, a good old chap, you know, talking about fried clams and using this kind of antiquated verbiage to just like have this little jokey rapport with his son. And the son, you know, as well played by Noah Jupe, is like, what is going on? This is like creepy, creepy, creepy. And then Jonathan says, no, not the father, you know, not the me that you know. And the way that he's able to disassociate those two things, I think that's a really compelling psychological portrait, and you know, maybe the strength of that gets a little bit lost in people's kind of anticlimactic you know, disillusion with like how the show ended.
I completely agree. I will say, like, watching the car chase scene, even before it becomes a chase, I had never seen Hugh Grant do anything like that. I 1,000% agree with you. And I was like, this is really fascinating to watch him do something yeah, as you say, it's like I kept thinking of him as like in the last few episodes, a caged animal, just like, you know, backing into one corner after another corner after another corner and trying to scrabble his way out. And we see it earlier in the episode when he like tries to shift the blame to his son, which feels like a breaking point for everyone in the family, right? And then we see it here where he's just sort of like in a very manic way, like very Henry Hill in Goodfellas with the helicopter overhead sort of way, like the walls are closing in. I'm desperately clinging to this persona that I crafted for myself. Like that's what caused him. I don't know. It was the motivator for him to kill Elena was her threatening his like separate personality that he had built for himself, right?
And her insistence that she knew him.
Right.
You know, this, like, you're never going to leave me. And he's like proving her wrong. He's proving his like dominion over her. He's like, you know, he's offended by the idea that anyone, let alone this, like, you know, mistress, would presume to have that kind of authority over him. You know, to know what someone's going to do, to know like their weaknesses, is to kind of lord something over them. And he just couldn't abide that, you know?
Yeah.
And I buy that. Like, I totally, like, that totally makes sense in the show's psychology.
But that disassociation that he has, like, he's like, that's not me. Like, the real me is the child oncologist, is, you know, pediatric oncologist, is your father, is like Grace's husband. That's the real me. And it's just, it's fascinating to watch him cling to that as like everything falls apart around him. Honestly, yeah. The finale was a mixed bag for me, but like there are some real bright spots in the courtroom drama and in several performances. I think I just wish the whole thing had hung together a little differently, or that I felt like it was less invested in twists and turns and trying to keep me constantly guessing, and more and just like digging into these characters. You have these incredible performances from these incredible performers, you know what I mean? And that's really, I honestly fundamentally think that's all you needed for this show to keep us engaged. So
I think also, I don't always want this, but I think in this case I could have used some sort of coda or epilogue or something, because I think that one of the big undoings that is not really investigated by the show, because it just runs out of time and then ends, is that by Grace doing that on the stand, she has destroyed her career. She has shown herself in the public's perception, in depending on how much of the public believes that it was purposeful.
Yeah.
You know, she has, but there is enough doubt hanging in the air that she, like, how would anyone ever pay her, what, $600 an hour to assess their, like, perception of the world, you know, and to, like, give them advice, essentially, you know, and she's cognizant of that. She can't not be. And so I just wanted maybe something, some kind of extra beat at the end after the big climax that like indicates something toward like what life is going to be like her. I mean, obviously financially she's fine. Her father is ungodly wealthy. You know, there's no concern about that material thing, but like her public identity, her son's identity, their standing in this carefully curated community of rich assholes is essentially over. And her career is over, I think, but I guess we're just left to kind of ponder that and you know, wonder what if.
I hope she and Henry and probably Donald Sutherland and maybe Lily Rabe will come with them, like all move to California or something. Let's go to Monterey. Oh, sure. Go to Monterey and start over.
Oh, God.
But like she has enough money that she doesn't need her career. Not that that, like, if her work is rewarding to her, I'm not saying it doesn't matter that she doesn't have that. But like, I'm actually, the coda that I'm interested is like, how traumatized is Henry by all of this in his life? You know what I mean? Like you were sort of talking last week about how you suspected this would be a sort of like, we need to talk about Kevin kind of story. And I kind of think it still could be. You know what I mean? Like, Henry's going to come out the other side of this. I mean, like, the kid ran the the hammer through the dishwasher twice. Like, you know what I mean? This kid has some things going on, and he experiences incredibly awfully traumatic thing with his father here at the end, in addition to all the other traumatic things. So there, you know, there is some questions about Henry's future. Like, Grace is ultimately the reason, though I kind of think she should have made her mind up before, but ultimately it seems like the reason Grace decides to sort of send Jonathan away as best she can is, you know, what her father says to her, which is like, you know, this is, he's going to be in your life forever. He's going to be around your son forever if you don't do something about this.
You know? And it kind of made me wonder, like, if the hammer being this sort of last straw thing for her, where she was like, okay, this is it. Now I'm, you know, joining the opposition in secret. If what that indicates is like she knew the whole time, you know, and that she was hoping maybe that there was some rational explanation or that there was some way that they would get out of it and then they would deal with it later, you know. But when she saw that all of that compromise could also threaten her son directly.
Yeah.
She was like, oh, well, never mind then. I'm giving up the charade, you know. But in a very, you know, strategic way.
Well, I mean, we hear the 911 call. Which we had already seen, but, you know, hearing it played in court is another thing entirely. But, like, and we also know that Grace went and had sex with him anyway, which we talked about after that. And that, to me, that moment where she goes back to her house that she shared with him and has sex with her husband is like, I really need to cling to my old life. And that is the most interesting. That is what I believe that I haven't read it, but I believe that that's what the book is about, is like, how do I let go of my life before? And yeah. And as far as I understand it, a question of like, how can I even do my job? How can I claim to be able to do my job if I didn't see this coming, sort of thing. So, I don't know. It's kind of fascinating. It's a really fascinating season of television in terms of like what went really right and what didn't quite work for me. And like how something can have such high highs and such things that don't work like right next to each other, almost scene by scene sometimes. So I don't know. I'm glad we did it. I'm glad we undid ourselves this fall, Richard.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's been interesting, and I think it's been a really interesting study in expectation, and, like, I think, what you made the right point in saying that, like, all the show needed was these good performances and these interesting characters, and the rest would have followed, and I agree with you, but the problem is they set it up as something else, you know, and didn't really deliver the goods on that front, with also, I think, at the end, some sort of indulgences toward like thriller stuff with the helicopter and the chase and, you know, why does this private helicopter allowed to land on this bridge where there are tons of police, you know, things like that, where you're like kind of scratching your head. But I think at root, you know, it was only, what, 5 episodes? And like, so it wasn't a huge investment of our time. It helped pass, you know, some dreary weeks, you know, and
a very stressful time. Well, you know, what's
6 episodes, I guess it was, sorry.
Yeah, well, what's interesting, when you said it's an interesting exercise in expectation, what's fascinating is we were like, oh, we'll cover We Are Who We Are while we're waiting for The Undoing, was sort of the conversations we had behind closed doors. We were just sort of like, well, we know we want to do The Undoing because it's this like big glossy like Kidman Grant, like, you know, whodunit. And like I said, I'm not upset that we did it at all, but We Are Who We Are really snuck up on us, which we talked about as like, it's one of my favorite things that I watched this year. And I had no expectations going into it. In fact, like, to be perfectly, perfectly, perfectly transparent, up until last minute, we thought we were going to do a different show. And then we sort of switched at the last minute to We Are Who We Are. So like, that is something that I've been really delighted by in doing this show with you, is sort of like walking into certain things and expecting that that's going to be the thing, and then actually discovering something that I had very low or no or whatever expectations around winds up being the thing that really sticks with me. So if folks are listening to this and they didn't happen to watch We Are Who We Are with us, I really recommend you go back and check that out, because I just think it was astonishing. And then this had its joys as well. But like that really, really stole my heart, you know, this fall. So,
yeah. Yeah. It was, I guess, really a testament to like, if the thing seems initially worthy, like putting the time in and like investing it, you know, and sometimes it pays off and sometimes it doesn't, in the way you'd hoped. But, you know, they're both really interesting things. And, I am glad that like with other services or channels kind of, I think, losing a bit of their quality momentum, HBO, I think, is still operating on a pretty high level, even with this show, which, you know, turned out to be pretty silly in some ways.
Yeah, it's I just like, I honestly, I had a pretty good time watching the finale, like even the parts that made me laugh, yeah. Like the hammer going through the dishwasher twice. Like, I didn't watch it last night because I was getting my Christmas tree, but like I saw someone tweet something like, he put the hammer in the dishwasher, the show is a comedy. And I was just like, I don't know, there's just like, and what's funny about what is really interesting about The Undoing is like, I didn't know how many people were watching the show, because it didn't seem like there was a lot of conversation around it. And then all of a sudden, everyone was talking about the finale last night, at least on my Twitter and several other people's like Twitter feeds. And I think that's kind of a fascinating thing. And I was just sort of like, never underestimate the power of the HBO Sunday night. Like, just some people, that's what HBO has that no other channel has, is this like ownership of our time on a Sunday night, where it's just like you follow the time slot week to week. Not every person and not every show, for sure, but there's a lot of people for whom they're like, whatever it is that HBO decides is worthy of the Sunday night slot, that's what I would be watching right now. And I think that that's I don't think any of, you know, no other channel has that. And, you know, NBC used to have that with its like Thursday block, but no other channel has that. And certainly no streaming platform has that. You know, streaming platforms have other powers. HBO Max, you know, is trying to get a piece of that power. But like HBO proper Sunday night, that's an institution that still stands in amongst all of this, which is interesting to me. All right, let us wrap things up here with our conversation with Nicole Kidman. Once again, this was you know, recorded at the beginning of the season, so no finale questions here as well. But interested to hear about her process, especially on the heels of Hugh Grant's description. Like, if you listen to Hugh Grant's interview last week, his description of working with her, and then her description of her own process, which is different. And, you know, I find that kind of interesting to hear like coworkers describe the same experience from a different point of view. So here we go. Here is Nicole Kidman on Playing Grace.
Thank you so much. Hello, Nicole. Thank you so much for chatting with me. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you. Thanks for chatting with me.
I was speaking to Susanna this morning, and she let me know that the script as she originally received it wasn't as much of a whodunit thriller, and it was sort of her desire to do a thriller that changed the project. How did that align with what you wanted or envisioned the project to be?
I mean, I went into this with David E. Kelly presenting two episodes of this limited series, saying, would you be interested in playing Grace, which was like a gift from the heavens, because that rarely happens as an actor, where there's just something that's so well written and tight just sort of gets given to you. And then Susanna and I had circled for many years, with the possibility of working, but there was never any project, but we'd met at parties and we share an agent, and there was always a discussion about how great she was. And I was a huge fan of a lot of her films that she made in Denmark. And obviously The Night Manager was, just riveting, and the way she handled that that genre and mixed it and gave it such wonderful character depth, but also managed to produce a huge thriller, you know, that was global and spanned the world. And she directed all of those episodes. So she, I just wanted to work with her. And when she came in, it was basically more like me going, what is your vision? Here's the show, but obviously you're a filmmaker and now you take it and mold it and make it what you wanted, the story you want to tell with this template of these characters.
Something I love about the character of Grace, and a number of people have talked to me about this, is this idea that she both very much fits into this world. She was born into it and doesn't fit in, is an outsider in a couple of ways. And I'm wondering how you tackled that personally from your performance.
That's probably a sort of a similar place in which I come from, where a lot of the times I've felt, you know, I can move through different worlds, but I've probably, because of being a transient person and just being a very artistic person since I was really, really young, and having a slightly odd sensibility and view of the world and being raised with a family that was very just always thinking out of the box. I think I always have felt like an outsider. I've never, and maybe everybody in the world feels like this, I've actually not met many people who go, oh yeah, I just have always felt like I've been popular and been able to fit in and can sort of mix in any place and never feel. So it's probably a deep part of many people's psyches, but it's obviously a deep part of mine. And so that's where I related to her and her quietness. I mean, she's an introvert ultimately, but she's very she's open, but she also has her boundaries, and she protects her heart. And I think that's probably a place that I come from as well.
That it also shines through in these incredible costumes that are both, you know, of course, you know, Grace has scads of money,
but she has her own style, which very much is very distinctive. You know, she's not that was part of the thing that Scene, who's worked with Susanna, she was the costume designer, and Susanna both had a very, very strong take on what they wanted. And I remember doing the initial wardrobe fittings, and we tried on some things, and it was far more bohemian, and there was a lot of vintage things, and we were sort of trying them. And then Susanna came in and sat on the couch while we were trying things on. She's like, no, 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 in her gorgeous direct way. And so then slowly it came, the character evolved in our eyes as we held it. And a lot of it just had to be made, because it wasn't things that you could find in the store. I mean, that green coat is extraordinary. It's unbelievably heavy, I might add.
Oh, no.
It's like wearing a massive blanket, heavy weighted blanket.
Did that help in a certain degree in terms of, you know, walking the streets of New York and in a depressive, shell-shocked funk, and you've got this heavy thing weighing you down? Does that help you?
Yes, it's sensorially that was very helpful, but at the same time it felt very protective, and it felt like a blanket, and it felt like a way in which I could sort of hide underneath it, even though it was very eye-catching. And she also always talked about this as a dark fairy tale. So there's that slightly fairy tale aspect to walking through the forest and all of those cinematic things that she layers in, and the hair and all of that. There's a reason for it, because nothing is just sort of random or by chance. I mean, it's all sort of the texture of the series is very, very thought out. And then what is created on the set is something very, very loose, actually, where the blocking and the ideas of the scenes get found on the day amidst these extraordinary backdrops, which is a really wonderful way to work as an actor. And so things, the way she saw certain scenes suddenly would really change as Donald and I, or Hugh and I, or Nora and I were mining them. And then we had Lily Rabe, who's just divine, and Noma, who came in and just sort of just commanded the set. I mean, she really did, because she's done so much stage, and she was such a find for us. We were so lucky to have her, because she just comes in with such weight and such intelligence and power, and just dominated all of us.
I wanted to ask you, Edgar Ramirez had some interesting things to say about how he reads the Joe and Grace interactions. And I'm wondering what your read is on their relationship.
I mean, I really wanted Edgar. We had to move schedule. He was shooting another film, and I was just like, I wanted him. And so I was like, I don't care what it takes. We have to have Edgar. I think I just felt that there would be a frisson between us, mm-hmm. which couldn't be defined. There was an aggression to him, but there was also care. There was he's sort of inscrutable at times, and he's very attractive and compelling. And I think all of the complexities of that help this this relationship, where he's basically questioning me as firstly as a victim and then as a perpetrator. And so, and the swing of that was really interesting. We would talk, but I communicate a lot of times with the actors with a slight veil of the character that I'm playing. So you seem, I talk, but a lot of what you're getting will be this sort of weird mix of, in that case, you know, Grace Nicole. And right now I'm playing sort of a Russian wellness retreat guru, so who's Russian, so called Marsha. So I have elements of that when I'm on the set talking to people. I'm like, I can't wait till I shed this person and I can actually emerge as me.
Yeah.
So it's weird, but you're not sort of addressing me as the character's name, but I do say on the set of the thing I'm doing right now, I stay totally in the accent, as I do with Grace. I don't use my Australian accent at all. I just stay totally in that place. Because I find it very hard to switch. Yeah. It feels too much like a technician if I'm doing those switches just on a dime. I much prefer the blurring of the visceral and the technical.
That's so interesting, because Hugh Grant said sort of exactly the opposite, in terms of he was envious of your ability to dive in and pull out and dive in and pull out of a scene on a dime. And he was like, I need to get my headphones on and get in my mood and hear my music, and Nicole can just come and go. But you're saying your secret is you're always halfway in when you're in a given project.
Okay. Yes. So how I'm relating, or the questions that he would ask me and the way I would answer, a lot of times would be imbued with Grace, which he probably wasn't attuned to, because he's just getting, you know, which is fantastic. Because I don't know. It's and Donald knew that about me. And I think Lily sort of knows that. But yeah, well, that's good that Hugh had that feeling.
What's your relationship with Donald Sutherland? Have you two worked before?
Yes, we did Cold Mountain together.
Oh, of course.
And he's also one of the heroes of American cinema. So, you know, he's worked with,
yes.
I mean, not just American, European as well. So he's really one of the people that you just go, I cannot believe that I get to sit here and talk to him, act with him. And, you know, he's quite paternal to me. So I already have that, that sense. He's tall and he's got that beautiful silver hair, and you just want to put your head on his shoulder and have him hold you.
That's very relatable, actually.
And he would wear those beautiful coats, and I just want to sort of fold into him.
I'm curious, you know, this project, the premiere of it was delayed because of everything that's happening everywhere, obviously. And, but that means that the audience who will be watching this show now is, I would say, demonstrably different than the audience that would have watched it in the spring. We've all changed so much, or most of us have anyway, with everything that's going on globally. Have you thought about that at all, about how the audience may perceive the story differently here in the fall than it would have in the spring?
I think we all felt very, very sad when it couldn't come out when it could. You know, there's a trajectory for a show that you go, okay, we're on this now. But then there's also that place where you're in control of nothing. Ultimately, things fall where they're going to fall. And that's the nature of art. And artistically, as much as we all want to go, okay, we're going to plan this, and this is the release dates, and this is what's going to happen, that all becomes, you know, you really get that lesson that there is no preparing or timing or any of those things. And I'm actually quite glad in a way, because things find their way, and now how it's perceived will be, yeah, we made it in a different climate, but it still resonates, I think, deeply. And hopefully human beings are still the same in terms of their needs, their desires, their losses, their the way in which we all, you know, this is the deepest part of this is the person I love ultimately is not what it's who they seem. But I desperately want to believe that they are. So what does that mean, and how do I? And that's a theme that has run through literature for you know, centuries. So it's just now the story's told with a different backdrop. So it is what it is. And there is the white privilege part of it, which now becomes very, very sort of fascinating. And then the demise of it. And that's interesting too.
To follow up on that, this might seem like a silly question, but I've been really enjoying people's responses, so I'm going to ask you anyway, which is, what is your read on the title of the show, The Undoing? What do you feel like is most fundamentally undone by the story we see unfold here?
Well, that gives the ending away. I mean... That's an you know, without sort of talking about it through the lens of grace, and therefore giving the whole story away. Part of the protection of the series is just going, take the ride, find, yeah. And that's been the greatest thing to see people respond to the ride. I think there is a sense of wanting to just escape into something that I can, you know, just good, thriller roller coaster. And as much as we all want to give enormous depth to everything, there is that aspect where you just go, I want to go on a ride. And that's been the response when I've had friends see it and everything. They're just like, I'm jonesing for the next step. Give it to me. Give it to me. Give it to me. But I also think when you have a Scandinavian or European director making this story, that gives it, that's also a lens you're looking for. You have an American writer, but you then bring in, so for me, it's extremely global because the cast is global and very diverse, and you have many different nationalities, and you have many different, but you ultimately have a female who is Danish telling this story, and she's deeply female, which I think you feel through the series, but men seem to still be compelled by it, which is, you know, that's very Susanna. She's the mother of a son. She's managed to carve a career from a generation of women that didn't have really any opportunities as directors, and yet she found her way. And she has this really interesting view on masculinity as well, but she's deeply female.
My last question for you is about Susanna. I've heard so many interesting stories about her process, whether it's, you know, giving you more rehearsal time or allowing you to warm up in, you know, on set before you dive into the scene itself, or the way her camera moves, which is can zoom in awfully close on a random object at any given time. What for you is the most delightful or productive aspect of her specific process?
Her just innate confidence in how she how she understands the camera, how she understands performance, and how she understands storytelling. So she has, because of her experience, she brings so much with her. And part of a director's, you know, job is answering so many questions, but keeping her vision intact and not being pulled off the ultimate goal, which is what she wants to make. And she's just so adept at handling that. Yet you still feel, and I still felt very much a part of the process. She was incredibly loving to me. She's very, very strong and rigorous, but she's got this underlying care. And she's very dignified. So there's that dignity, which I think bleeds through into her, into the way in which she handles her characters. She treats them all with a lot of dignity. And that's a beautiful thing to watch. But she also, we would be sitting there and I'd be like, oh my gosh, she's shooting my eye, you know? and she doesn't tell you, she just does it. Which is a wonderful thing as an actor. So I would just have to stay in the emotion in the character, and thus things would just happen. Sometimes she'd shoot silent takes. She shoots with different cameras. We had a fantastic DP as well, Anthony, who's just a wonderful, wonderful DP. We had a great camera operator, Roberto. And the synchronicity between them was very powerful. So there was it was just filmmakers, really strong filmmakers who are mature and grown-ups. And that's nice to be surrounded by that. There's so much noise and there's so much distraction, but hey, you know, it's fallen where it's meant to fall and off it goes. And now hopefully the work finds its way. The storytelling does.
Before we head out, you and I have one more episode to record this season. We're going to do one last flight attendant episode. Anthony Bresnikan and I are going to do two episodes on The Mandalorian. We've got an episode dropping this week on The Mandalorian and Rosario Dawson and all of that sort of stuff. So there's going to be basically three more still watching episodes for the rest of the year. One more with Richard, two more with Anthony, and then it's on to 2021, and we don't know what we're going to be doing then. If you have any suggestions, you can always let us know. But I just really love this email from one of our listeners, who I believe his name is Kieran, if I know my Irish name pronunciations correctly. And Kieran wrote, hi, Joanna and Richard. I hope you both had a lovely Thanksgiving. Just dropping a quick note to say that I got quite unexpectedly emotional in the last episode when you discussed wrapping up for the year. I first came across your podcast back in March of this year when The Mandalorian finally made its way to Ireland. Rude to come so late considering they used Irish locations for the sequel trilogy. And I've listened to this podcast through that series, plus Westworld, plus The Undoing, and Now We Are Who We Are, which premiered here last week. Once I noted that we are reaching the end of the year, I didn't realize how much I looked forward to diving into this podcast series after I watched the latest episode of whatever it is currently being watched, and how much your voices in my ear on one of my quarantine walks was like a warm hug and offered a sense of comfort and normality on a weekly basis. That's all I really have to say, and I look forward to following whatever it is that's up next, and I wish you both a happy holidays, and hopefully 2021 is kinder to all of us. Thanks, Kieran. So that was a lovely email from Kieran.
That's so nice.
Yeah. And it was just like really lovely. I know a lot of you just sort of like decide to watch whatever we decide to watch. And we really value your time and you hanging out with us series to series. And, you know, if you hopped on the still watching train late, there's a whole bunch of old stuff that you can go listen to. Hey, have you seen Sharp Objects? Go watch that and listen to us talk about that. That was one of my favorite ones.
Hog Heat. Yeah. We had a whole catchphrase for that.
So, you know, there's a bunch of old series that we did, but I just thought that was really sweet from Kieran, and we could all use a little holiday warm wishes. So we will be back one more time. We've already got a couple great flight attendant emails from you guys, but email us still watching pod@gmail.com, and we will hit those flight attendant emails and hit that finale when it airs in December. And Richard, until then, where can folks find you?
Well, I'm excited to say I am going dog shopping with Henry because he can finally get one now.
Yay, Henry! Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, you know, he was long denied that, and now, you know, now he's free to do it. So we're going to be going to the shelter and trying to find a good dog for him and Grace. In the meantime, I will be tweeting at Ryla's, writing reviews, including, best of the year list will be up on December 1st, best movies of the year. And then Sonia Soraya's best TV of list year. Sonia Soraya's best TV of the year list will be up also this week. So please check those out at vf.com. Joanna, until we get on board a plane with Kelly Cuoco again, where will you be?
Well, I'm actually going shopping with Henry as well, but we're shopping for dishwashers because I'm pretty sure they need a new one at the lake house after what that other one's been through. Yes, I think I know what Sonia's number one. She told me what her number one show is, and I think I agree with it. And it's actually kind of a recent show, one we haven't talked about. And I think that'll be a fun thing for people to check out if they haven't already. So read Sonia's list, then go watch her number one if it is what I think it is. And we will be back to fly the friendly skies or the not so friendly skies with Kaley Cuoco. Also, we had a great flight attendant theory email. It was so good that Richard texted it to me, and then I also got a copy in my inbox. So like, send us your theories. I'm gonna love all the flight attendant theories. So send us those to watchingpod@gmail.com, and we will see you later in December. Bye.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.